This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about a Santa Barbara group that has responded to the pandemic at home and abroad.
Every time there's a big emergency, people who are lower income get hit harder. In the United States, income and wealth is closely associated with race.
Also, we'll learn about a summer music program for serious young musicians.
I joke with the students all the time when I get to know them that this is chamber music boot camp. I mean, they are playing their instrument right after breakfast and they're not done till dinner.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, March 15th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. Direct Relief, headquartered in Santa Barbara, has a long history of providing aid for medical emergencies around the world. Contributor Beth Thornton talks with the CEO and president about responding to the COVID-19 pandemic here on the Central Coast and abroad.
Let's get started with a brief history of Direct Relief.
I'm Thomas Tighe, president and CEO of Direct Relief.
Welcome.
Yeah, well, it's a fascinating story. It was founded by really two war immigrant businessmen who had fled the Nazis in Europe in the 40s and ended up with some of their wealth intact in Santa Barbara, of all places. So what's now Direct Relief was originally the kind of a private effort of the money person, William Zimden, who was from Estonia, who initially was just sending cash and food and clothing to his former employees and people he knew personally. That evolved into the William Zimden Foundation, where it was his own funding of similar activities. But I think in the late 40s, when it was formally established in 1948, the business instincts kicked in. And as the story goes, I mean, I wasn't around, but I think it was one of the early movers to recognize and start what we now call corporate social responsibility. So here was a business person who was seeing people in need who couldn't afford to buy anything. And so using his own money as a business person, going to other business people and saying, look, these people in bombed out post-war Europe need what you're making, but they can't buy it. So I'm putting in my own money. Would you be willing to do something to help? What's now Direct Relief kind of started with that, those instincts, and really inviting the participation of anyone who had something to provide for a humanitarian health purpose. And, here 73 years later, we're still basically operating on the same model, staying out of politics, trying to move and mobilize and provide resources that people need when they're either stuck in a position of chronic poverty or hit by an emergency. It's still non-political. It's still entirely privately funded. We don't have any religious affiliation at Direct Relief, but the simple humanitarian purpose has been consistent throughout.
So it started right here in Santa Barbara. Is this the only branch or office of Direct Relief?
Well, we have Direct Relief Mexico, which is essentially a subsidiary of Direct Relief that performs the same functions within Mexico. Similarly, in Direct Relief South Africa, they're both locally organized, recognized nonprofit organizations in both South Africa and in Mexico, and have a board of directors that many of the members are shared by the current board of directors of Direct Relief. So we have three entities, but Santa Barbara is still the global headquarters.
You have a lot of experience getting aid and medicines all over the world, and that you've responded to Zika and Ebola and other crises like that. How has COVID-19 been different, if it has been?
Yeah, well, I think Ebola, for example, I think the most recent severe, scary outbreak, as often happens, I think in that case, we have been working with groups in West Africa for years. And when the Ebola arose, that was our point of contact. And so we were looking at the unfolding situation through the lens of people that we were already supporting. But most emergencies, I mean, each is unique to the particular circumstances, but all similar in that you have whatever problems you had pre-existing compounded by this new threat. And so there's this rapid adjustment of resources and activities. So I think we were very active in West Africa and understanding that how important it is to do everything possible to prevent the spread. So very similar to how COVID has unfolded, you know, with PPE was short immediately, prices became, you know, spiked, supply just distribution channels became clogged because, you know, there was the commerce shut down in West Africa because people didn't want to go in or leave. So I think that was relatively contained, still a tragic episode of loss of over 10,000 lives. But, you know, the same basic dynamics existed. What's different in COVID is that it, you know, it's simultaneously occurring everywhere. So whereas if it's a geographically isolated event like a fire or a flood or an earthquake, the typical approach is to mobilize resources from other places and swarm them into where they're needed and try to do it coherently and backstop the existing infrastructure and for health and everything else that gets overwhelmed. That's really hard. It's impossible to do when that same dynamic is occurring simultaneously everywhere in the world, right? So I think we scrambled to try to scale as fast and as much as we could, but basically building on the same backbone that DirectRelief has created over 73 years of functionally performing a distribution function at no charge for, you know, good organizations that we know and trust and have qualified so that they have access to resources they need but can't afford. So, you know, it's been just a much expanded version of that over the past year.
Your work not only involves logistics, but you also have to acquire and plan ahead, right?
A business, you would call it forecasting sales, right? And the dilemma is that, you know, businesses which do that very well, what they don't do is forecast who's not going to buy our products, right? That's not a particularly interesting issue for a business to think about who's not going to buy what they're selling. That is our business to kind of see, well, who is unable to buy and is not going to show up on a potential sales forecast, but is going to be in need, you know, predictably. So I think that's what we do on an ongoing basis, try to size the unmet demand for, you know, health essentials and try to take that information to those in a position to address those gaps and ask them if they'd be interested in helping out. I think in emergencies, we, you know, do some rapid calculation based on population, based on existing need, trying to guess what is likely to be covered through either government sources or normal commercial activity, and size that need that we then try to address in a coherent way.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking today with Thomas Teig of DirectRelief. What has your COVID-19 response been right here on the Central Coast?
It's been very similar. I think we know, you know, the community health centers of the Central Coast, they're a fine organization that kind of span activities in both San Luis Obispo County and Northern Santa Barbara County. And they are essentially the safety net for over 100,000 people for health. In the South County, there's the Santa Barbara Neighborhood Clinics, and they're both federally qualified health centers whose basic mission is to serve underserved areas and people. So, and those who are undocumented or uninsured and don't have the financial wherewithal, and that's on a chronic ongoing basis. So, you know, knowing them, having high confidence in them, having a protocol where they could ask for materiel support and we could fulfill it rapidly. What we've done is provide PPE to them, provide any medication support that's needed that they found a need for, and then provide financial support to the extent we can. I think, you know, this week we announced that each of them, we were able to provide $150,000 in financial support to each organization, just so as the vaccination campaigns roll out and these facilities are being asked to participate to serve people who have been, you know, disproportionately affected. We want to make sure that they have all the financial support that they obviously need. It's new work for them that wasn't anticipated in their lean budgets.
Tell us about your cold storage capabilities. Do you really have a Tesla microgrid to keep everything running?
It's interesting how things shake out. I think back when Hurricane Maria hit in Puerto Rico now close to 3.5 years ago, we saw this scenario where they had a fragile power grid that went out. They lost all their medications and things like insulin that require cold storage on the whole island for over 3 million people. Health services were interrupted, and there was a spike in need for health services because of the crisis, and a decrease in capacity to provide health services just because of the power availability. And we did, you know, reluctantly at first, you know, we kept saying, what do you need? And they said, we need power. We thought, well, what else do you need? Because we don't really do power. And it turned out, it became obvious and unavoidable that directly helping them reestablish solar it's in the tropics, it's a perfect place for solar generation, but it had to be stored locally in batteries, because to push solar generated power into a grid that breaks doesn't do anyone any good. So we stepped back, worked with all the community health centers, like the Puerto Rican versions of the community health centers and neighborhood clinics here in Santa Barbara, and we helped them all get local power generation through solar and storage and batteries. And at the same time, we were building this new facility in Santa Barbara and thinking, well, the state of California lights on fire every year, and the power grid is not Puerto Rico vulnerable, but, you know, it's vulnerable, and there's predictable losses of power. And so we went ahead and said, gosh, as we're building a new facility to be a distribution hub for things like insulin and cancer medications, we better make sure that we're protected against the types of outage that could destroy all those products. So we put in a very large microgrid here at Direct Relief, worked with Tesla. We had the permit approved by our local planners in the state. It was the first microgrid approved in the continental United States. And we were, you know, doing it for practical reasons. Since then, with the Thomas fires and all the fires that have occurred, we have seen the same dynamic exist throughout the entire state of California, where it's almost worse than Puerto Rico and California, because in California, you are required to have electronic health records, even at a community health center. So if you don't have power, you don't have health records, so you don't know your patient's history, their medications, prescription regimen. So, you know, power now is a prerequisite for health delivery in the United States. Anyway, I think that's a long answer, but yeah, we have a big power grid, and as well as a big diesel generator, so that we can perform a critical infrastructure role.
So are you playing a formal role as backup support for refrigeration of vaccines?
Yes, Direct Relief was written into the state of California's plan as backup, if necessary, for handling and storing and then distributing vaccines that for COVID.
Is your next year focused on vaccines here and around the world?
Yeah, I think in the interim, I think a lot of what we've been doing internationally has been to work with countries where existing capacity to handle cold chain medications is much more limited than in the United States. And it has been very sobering to see, you know, that if the richest country in the history of the world, our own, struggles with basic distribution, including of PPE, which is not complex to handle and distribute, but certainly for the vaccinations and cold chain medications, I mean, it's been a stretch for the United States. So I think for us, working with many of the foreign countries that have asked for help, they know that we do this type of thing because we have charitable insulin programs that we do on an ongoing basis. We provide cancer therapies to many parts of Africa, where it's very important to make sure that the temperature is maintained throughout the transportation legs. So we have picked up a fair amount of information about what's required, and thinking through with groups like the Pan American Health Organization and the World Food Program, which is a UN agency that handles a lot of the logistics for the World Health Organization and UNICEF, how we can be helpful as a private organization that does this already. And obviously we want to help. Any information that we've got, any capacity that we have, is for the public benefit.
This is Beth Thornton. I'm talking today with Thomas Tighe of Direct Relief.
The priority has been in the United States because, surprisingly, the United States has been the hotspot for the world for most of the past year. And so our hope is that we can kind of get over the hump and the vaccination program will work and we will achieve herd immunity and things can eventually get back to normalcy. It's sobering to think of, just based on how challenging has been for the United States, that has not spared the spending.
Tell us about the Fund for Health Equity.
The Fund for Health Equity kind of arose concurrent with the what's been unfolding with respect to COVID, where, as often happens in emergencies, there's a recognition that, gosh, it is affecting people differently, which is not really a surprise if you do this all the time. I mean, this is the same thing every hurricane. I mean, every time there's a big emergency, certain places, people who are lower income get hit harder. In the United States, income and wealth is closely associated with race. And so we have seen COVID hit people of different races differently. I mean, this is widely documented that, people and communities of color, there was less testing. There was higher infection rates. There were more hospitalizations and disproportionate deaths compared to others. So what we've seen in COVID is tragic, but it's predictable and it's symptomatic of some underlying causes that are also widely known. So the Fund for Health Equity is a recognition that we are not taking our foot off the gas to do everything we can to make sure that the COVID is addressed. And we're aiming at the areas where the effects are worst. But I think with this generous support that's emerged, including from Mackenzie Scott, the philanthropist, and some of the companies we've worked with, it was intended to look beyond COVID and to look at what might make a difference to strengthen access to health services or general health conditions better for the people who have been slammed so hard by COVID.
On a personal note, is it ever overwhelming, especially when multiple disasters are happening simultaneously?
I suppose if we thought about it too much, it can be overwhelming. But the best antidote for the sense of being overwhelmed in life, I think, is to focus on something and work on it.
Thomas Tighe, thank you so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This is Beth Thornton for Issues and Ideas.
For today's nonprofit story, KCBX contributor Consuelo Mukes reached out to Michael Whitson of Pacific Crest Music Festival to learn about this summer program that takes place in Northern California and its connection to San Luis Obispo.
This is the nonprofit story. I am your host, Dr. Consuelo Mukes, talking to Michael Whitson, the founder and director of Pacific Crest Music Festival. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Consuelo. Happy to be here.
Yes, you're so welcome. Pacific Crest Music Festival is so exciting. Tell us all a little bit about this vision that you had to bring students to a wonderful area and teach them about chamber music.
So the vision really came from my experience as a student through high school and my undergraduate and graduate degrees, where students pursuing music like I was at the time, often during summers, you're going off to music festivals around the country and even around the world. And I started to see that the recipe for success of these places was kind of a destination location, a place that students really love to go visit, someplace fun and exciting and beautiful, not much surrounding competition, and then just a very high level faculty. Mm-hmm. And I realized that As I grew as a professional musician, I realized I could find the faculty with all my friends, all my colleagues. And so my family had a summer home in Northern California, in the Shasta area, Dunsmuir, California. And I spent so much time there and realized the place was just perfect. It checked all those boxes. And mm-hmm. we gave it a shot in 2013, and it's just grown ever since.
First of all, tell us a little bit about you. I know that you have a really extensive background. I hear you've worked with some of the artists that I just absolutely love, including Barbara Streisand and Stevie Wonder and Yo-Yo Ma.
Well, musical family. My father ran a youth orchestra, founded and ran a youth orchestra until the day he passed away in Palo Alto, California. And so I was surrounded by young musicians and professionals and music my whole life. And I had no intention of going on into music. And when it came time to go to college, I realized I did 6 months at a city college. Mm-hmm. And realized I missed music so much that I ended up at the San Francisco Conservatory, and the rest is kind of history. I've had fun. It really is an interesting career, and it's taken me all over the world. Some of the most amazing people and experiences. It's just been a pleasure.
So you stepped into this professional world of music, apparently, and just how did that happen? Because it sounds like something you're trying to do with the students you work with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what we try. One of the things that I feel, I don't want to say the system kind of failed me and my colleagues in college, but we weren't prepared so well for the real world in music. Because it's there's another side to it, obviously, that can be tough. Mm-hmm. And so that is something that we work with our students quite a bit is, like you just mentioned some names, Barbara Streisand and Stevie Wonder. I, as a violist at the conservatory in San Francisco, that wasn't on my radar at all. I thought I was going to be an orchestral musician.
Yeah.
And I realized there's so many possibilities in the world of music, teaching and different genres of music. I do a lot of studio work down in Southern California for TV and film. And that, you know, these are just things that no one told me that those were possibilities.
What made you want to work with students or young people to bring them up to this adventure?
Again, I think it kind of runs in the family. I just saw what my dad was doing and gravitated towards teaching. Even I was teaching young students even when I was in undergrad. And so I've always been teaching private lessons. I moved to Los Angeles in 2006 after grad school. And had the pleasure of working with, being a Los Angeles Philharmonic teaching artist, working with some inner city students, a wonderful program, Youth Orchestras of Los Angeles. I fell in love with teaching and working with young people and realized I really needed both the teaching and the performance side to balance out my enjoyment of this career.
Mm-hmm. So let's get really specific and tell the listening audience, what is the Pacific Crest Music Festival?
Sure. Well, I mean, you gave us a beautiful introduction. It's a very small and purposely small, very intensive chamber music festival that happens for 10 days every summer. Chamber music being string quartets, piano trios, just very small ensembles where students, it's kind of the best of both worlds. They get a chance to have like a solo voice because they're the only person playing their part. Yet you still get to work in a collaborative type environment where you're playing with other people. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you can't hide. When I'm sitting in a viola section of 16 other violas, if I miss a note, no one knows. But when you're on stage playing in a string quartet, if you mess up, everybody knows.
Everybody knows, yeah.
So it's a wonderful environment for them to really train and kind of hone their craft and really keep that going over the summer. Obviously, you don't want to stop your studies for 3 months during the middle of summer. So that's why students seek out festivals like our own. And one aspect of that I think should be discussed with PCMF, Pacific Crest Music Festival.
Yes.
Has always been a cornerstone of it is this the diversity aspect. We are hard to work with other countries. Within our own, within the U.S., with inner city programs like the one I worked within Los Angeles, incorporating that into our festival because in the classical music world, it's not, diversity hasn't been there like it needs to be over the last 100 years.
Right, exactly. It's so true. So tell us a little bit about the students. You were saying there are not that many of them. Yeah. So tell us, who are they? Where do they come from? How do you find them? Sure. How do they find you?
Well, then that's the nice part of us growing over the years is now instead of me having to go out and recruit a student body every year, which is tiring, they are coming to us for the most part now. And we have some incredible faculty teachers who are also professors. Like all of our faculty this year are they're all in academia. So a lot of, they bring a lot of their students as well.
Now you're in academia too.
I am. I teach at Cal Poly. And actually the cellist on our faculty, Laura Gainan, she teaches cello at Cal Poly as well.
Okay. Okay. So back to the students.
yeah. I mean, so just imagine from all walks of life, different social economic backgrounds. We at last year, or last year, I need to stop saying that. There was no last year in the musical, in the music festival world. But in 2019, right. For instance, we had students coming from all over California, all over the U.S. We had students from Colombia, Venezuela, Puerto Rico. In the past, we've had students from Japan. And a lot of these students, we really... It means a lot to me to bring on a young musician who you can tell is taking things very seriously and very passionate about music, but just could not afford the cost of a typical US summer music festival. They're expensive for housing and food and participation in the program. The cost gets up there. So I've taken a lot of pride in handing out a large number of full scholarships over the years to students that without it, they just wouldn't have the opportunity.
So how many students do you have in the summer?
Well, this year is going to be a little different for obvious reasons as we navigate out of this whole pandemic. We're going very small, and I can't give you an exact number yet because we're actually right in the middle of the recruitment process. My guess, we usually have the golden number for me is about 18 to 20 students.
That's a great number.
Yeah, and this year I think we'll be around 12.
Okay.
12 students. We just want to keep things small for obvious reasons, and fingers crossed, everything's looking like it's pointing in the right direction. But of course, as a nonprofit business, we still want to be very careful, and we have a wonderful relationship with the community here, and I want to be respectful of that as well.
That sounds great. And if you are just joining us, this is The Nonprofit Story. I'm your host, Dr. Consuelo Mukes, and I'm speaking with Michael Whitson, the founder and director of the Pacific Crest Music Festival. So Michael, we keep saying that you have the students up here at camp. I know you are working and living in Cal Poly, and you have faculty that are coming from different universities, but where is the camp?
So the festival takes place in Dunsmuir, California, which is about 45 minutes south of an hour south of the Oregon border, right in the Shasta area. It is, it's a pleasure, Consuelo, to watch the students come from out of the country and their first experience of the United States is here. The volcano here, the river, it's just gorgeous. The town of Dunsmuir is a town of, I think it's 1,700 people. And they've really kind of taken this festival as their own and taken a lot of pride in it. And you'll see the students walking around with their cellos and violins on their backs during the day. The community just, they love it. They eat it up.
So tell us about the work, the festival itself, because I looked at the schedule that you have for the students on the website, and it is intense. So what's your expectations even of the students?
When I'm wearing my artistic director hat, it's finding this nice balance of like, okay, I don't want to overwork the faculty, but I really want the students to be, I just want them to immerse themselves in music. This is not, I joke with the students all the time when I get to know them that this is chamber music boot camp. I mean, they start playing their instrument right after breakfast and they're not done till dinner.
Wow.
And of course we'll give them breaks here and there, but they are here to learn. And we really stress that the fun is in the hard work. And I can honestly say I have not seen a student kind of push back on that at all in the 9 years that we've been doing this. They bond because of the small numbers, they bond quickly, and it becomes, I played a lot of sports when I was younger, and it becomes kind of a team effort, and people are feeding off each other, and it's really beautiful to watch.
So they are what, 16 and over, I think, or what is the age?
16 and up. This year especially, it started in 2019, but this year especially, it's mainly the bulk of our student body is going to be collegiate music majors. Students studying music. We have students coming from This year already signed up from San Francisco Conservatory, the Peabody Institute in Baltimore, other universities, Miami University, USC. So, you know, some of the big music schools across the country, and the students are now seeking us out to come here. And it's great. We have, it's a good problem to have when you have more applicants than you can accept. So we can I can really identify the student that I think is most suited and most deserving of this experience.
So you have all these applicants coming in and all these students who want to be with you. How are you going to select the few that can't actually come?
That's the hard part. And I'm glad I have an amazing faculty to help me with that. I wouldn't want to be doing that decision, making those decisions all on my own. But so obviously some of it is merit-based. We want very strong players. But again, going back to this idea, like I still work with the Los Angeles Philharmonic and this YOLA Youth Orchestras of Los Angeles. And I make sure every year that we can use one of those students from inner city Los Angeles and give them experience of coming up here. We provide them with a full scholarship every year. We work with the LA Phil. And that's just one example of, you know, those students aren't necessarily always our top players, but they're good young players, and an experience like PCMF can really help launch their young careers. Getting a chance to play with other musicians of high caliber.
When you say the inner city area, are these students who are still in high school or college, but they are music majors, so you have a way to audition them?
Yeah, so high school mainly. And they'll audition just like the rest of the students. We have started working with the LA Phil, and to their credit, they are being very supportive of their alumni as well, especially their alumni students who are now majoring in music across the country. Nice. So it's kind of, the answer is both.
Both then all above, huh? So you're there and you have the students there for 10 days in the summer with this intense program. What's the outcome from all of this? What do you expect to happen?
So the highlight every year for me, and this has happened every year, the highlight, I think people would assume it's the concerts. It's, you know, watching the students with the faculty in the trenches, so to speak, work. And no, it's for me, it's when the students are saying goodbye to each other at the end of every festival, and there's always tears. Every year there's been tears. And just to see the impact that we're having, I think students coming, like a student from Columbia meeting a student from Los Angeles, meeting a student from New York City, and they all just find this common theme of music and realize they all share this passion, and they become really close. And I think I can see the impact that we're having on them socially, to the point where we even have student advisors to the board at this point, alumni, who openly admit that they are still keeping in touch with many of the students that they went to PCMF with years ago.
That's great that you create that bond. And when they are there on the campus, though, I think you do give some performances, though. Isn't that correct?
Yep. So we do outreach all over. We've been going to retirement communities. We've been playing in like every single small school here, every single elementary school in the area we've covered. We've done juvenile detention centers. All of our performances are, whether it's faculty or student performances, they're open to the public. We do a suggested donation, but we want to make sure that anyone can come and enjoy the music. So it has been. You know, another aspect of this vision for me has been the connection with the community. So we just want to make sure we're bringing these small little communities up here don't get enough classical music. And I enjoy bringing that to them.
So the students do get to actually perform and be in front of an audience and get that experience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So we have two formalized concerts at the end of the festival. One is the small student orchestra. We'll play at this beautiful, the Dunsmuir Botanical Gardens. It's an outdoor concert right along the river. Very well attended. And then the next evening, they will break into their smaller chamber music groups and perform their quartets at a location up in Mount Shasta City.
Now, are you going to do anything in the San Luis Obispo area with some of the students?
So 5 years ago now, I moved out of Los Angeles and into San Luis Obispo and could not be happier. So the actual name of the business is Pacific Crest Music. The festival has really taken off and continues to grow very quickly. But the business itself, it's never been intended to just be the festival. So we're starting to add concert series. Before COVID, I was like at the 1 yard line of starting a very small, very intensive chamber orchestra for students in San Luis Obispo.
Oh.
And then COVID hit. But that is going to happen. The San Luis Obispo Youth Symphony has done an incredible job spreading music to a great number of students. And I found through playing with them and teaching, there's a handful of students that are really serious in the community in San Luis Obispo. Mm-hmm. And they really wanna they've come to PCMF and then they've come to me afterwards and say, I wanna do that during the year in San Luis Obispo. I would like to find ways to get that going. The youth orchestra is one. And we are actually, the faculty in early June is gonna be doing our first performance. We're gonna do a small fundraising house concert in San Luis Obispo. We've got some amazing players coming out. And so there's going to be more and more happening in that area. It's where I live, and it's where I would like to see things really grow.
It sounds like such a wonderful, unique experience for young people who really want to go into music and are really excited about it. How can people find out more about Pacific Crest Music Festival and get involved if they'd like to?
Sure. And that's the key at this point. We're in this kind of transformative period where it's been interesting to why no one knew who we were for the first six or
right.
7 years. Now people are starting to learn who we are. Mm-hmm. The website gives you the nuts and bolts of who we are, what we do. And that's PacificCrestMusic.com is our website. And that will give you the general information. And there's ways to support us both as volunteers or financially right there on the website. Thing is, come to a concert, whether it's faculty or student. I will talk a little bit about why it's so important to get local and community support. An interesting note, this performance that we're doing in June, we have a really fine cellist right here in San Luis Obispo, Colin Guan. He's a senior at San Luis Obispo High School. He's an incredible young player. The faculty is going to include him. He's going to be performing with the faculty at this concert in San Luis Obispo in June. So incorporating both the students and the faculty is going to be fun.
That sounds incredible, Michael. It is so fun to talk to you and to find out about Pacific Crest Music Festival. And again, they can go to the website at PacificCrestMusic.com. And you are a 501c3 nonprofit. And I just want to add in there, if somebody is interested in assisting, will this actually help students to come to the festival?
Absolutely. Every year we are providing a large number of full and then even partial scholarships to students. And that comes from support.
Michael, thank you so much. Speaking with Michael Whitson, he is the founder and director of the Pacific Crest Music Festival. And this has been the Nonprofit Story. This is Dr. Consuelo Mutes. Thank you for joining us.
The Atascadero Greyhound Foundation has helped many young people in the community face the challenges of drug abuse through a variety of programs. Now, there's a book aimed at helping others find the same success in their own communities.
Hello, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by Don Clickert, Executive Director of the Atascadero Greyhound Foundation. Welcome, Don.
Thank you, Brian. It's good to be here.
I almost stumbled on what to call you today because since we've known each other off and on for the past 20-plus years, you've worn many hats. But could you tell us a little bit about your journey to getting here today and in particular how it led to the creation of the new book, Lighthouse, Weapon, and Rescue?
I did my student teaching from Cal Poly. I did my student teaching at Atascadero High School and was hired as a teacher there. A special education resource specialist program, then became the athletic director shortly after being hired there. I was the athletic director for 34 years and taught about that same amount of time. I retired in 2004 and in 2005 was appointed to the school board and have been elected twice since to the board. So got a few hats we've worn during time.
The book in hand, Lighthouse, Weapon, and Rescue, the Lighthouse part reflects a subset, a committee of the Greyhound Foundation, correct?
Yes.
And the Lighthouse, Weapon of Rescue is an amazing book. It's a very painful book. although positivity runs throughout. But describe to us sort of the genesis of this book and what you hope it will accomplish.
Well, the genesis of the book, I think, follows the genesis of Lighthouse itself, that was formed in 2011 because we recognized that we were losing kids to drug use. It was very concerning, and there were a sequence of three deaths right in a row that caused us to, those of us who are board members of the Greyhound Foundation, to take a look at what we were doing and kind of refocus our general objectives. We refocused into the area of drug prevention. So that led us to the creation of the book because we wanted to have other people do the same thing that we were doing, people in other communities. So we wanted to write a manual to how to build a lighthouse. However, the manual, under the direction of Carol Gobler, who is our author, became much more than a manual. It became a story of the community of Atascadero's involvement in the prevention of drug abuse.
It's such a fundamental issue that touches on our humanity. And, of course, it reaches over into student life and athletics, because I'm guessing you can't really be a student who excels or an athlete who excels if you have that weight on you, the drug use and abuse.
That's true. And it's also true because we're interested in things besides athletics. If you're a drama, an actor, an actress in drama, or you're a singer in the choir, or you do any one of a number of things, if you're an agriculture kid, you cannot do that effectively if you have an addiction.
Right. You're hindered. And of course, as the book points out, a lot of that is hidden, even from parents and close friends sometimes.
Oh, definitely. And I think that's certainly from teachers and from coaches and administrators of programs. When they do recognize it and they see it as that addiction is a terrible thing for the person who's afflicted and also for the people who surround that person.
You know, I'm old enough to remember the DARE programs that started in middle school and up, and they got a lot of criticism for being too heavy-handed or not on point or not real and so on and so on. It seems like you have, and whether they deserve that reputation, those programs, I couldn't say, but that's what I've heard. But it seems like you've avoided the pitfalls with this program by being strategic, by being community-based, by having a whole raft of different activities and programs, not just one. I'm very amazed at what you guys have accomplished, but what you've done is different.
It seems to be that and we're being recognized actually now throughout the country for having the program that you just described that is different from the DARE concept of just don't do drugs. You know, Nancy Reagan, and she had great ideas, and the DARE program was one of them. But the idea to say just don't do drugs doesn't work. There has to be a substitute. There has to be some reason not to. And there has to be some way out if you get involved in any kind of an addictive substance.
One of the basic premises of the 12-step programs is anonymity is a threat. In other words, if you have a person has a secret life that they're ashamed of, but they're stuck doing, one of the first steps to recovery is to be in a supportive environment and tell your story. So have you had success in getting students to reach out when they need help?
Well, through programs that are that we fund, the Greyhound Foundation funds, along because of the efforts of our community, we have programs, wellness center programs in Paloma Creek High School, which is our continuation school, with Atascadero High School, and we will be starting a wellness center as soon as we get back to school. We'll be starting a wellness center at the middle school. So the wellness centers have at their head a licensed marriage and family therapist, and usually interns who are therapist interns working in those programs. Those are places where kids have found that they can go and have a listener and have a helper, somebody who really can help them with the addiction or the potential for addiction that exists in their lives for many reasons. We're approaching that from the fact that at our schools, we have a very open place where kids can come and talk and be part of the school. Our high school is the best example. Tasker High School is the only school in the county, the only high school in the county that has a wellness center that is staffed by a licensed marriage and family therapist, Kamala Pru, who does just an amazing job with those kids. And we're talking about, you know, anxiety and depression and addiction and all kinds of all kinds of problems that adolescents have that can be dealt with successfully by people who will listen and who people who have the training and who have the wisdom to be that person in those areas. So those three schools and also the Fine Arts Academy will all have access to wellness centers. So those have proven to be very, very important to our district and to the success of our kids.
A lot of the current controversies around policing and using of violence or lethal force, and policemen or a sheriff's deputy, they're not trained mental health therapists or youth advocates necessarily. They have other things on their duty belt to carry around. Some of the first responders, once the police have been aware of, you know, criminal activity, they're aware of it. But the front person, the head of it, as you would describe, has a mental health background or medicine or maybe even religion. But it's not necessarily the cop on the beat, but it's somebody who understands the psyche of kids in trouble.
I certainly agree with that one, Brian. And I think one of the things that makes our program here in Atascadero, the Lighthouse program, as valuable as it is that we have that cooperation from our first responders, from our police department, our fire department, and certainly the administration of the city of Atascadero to be a part of Lighthouse. That's one of the things that sets our program apart from programs throughout the country. And that is that we're not one solution based. We have a wellness center, but we have Reality Tour, which has the cooperation of the police department, the fire department, the Chamber of Commerce, the Chapel of the Roses, if we could have time to even talk about them. But all of the facets of our community, the service clubs, the private citizens, the businesses that support, we have every part of our community is a big part of the Lighthouse program.
That's a wonderful thing. I would like to remind everyone, this is Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we are joined by Don Clickard, Executive Director of the Atascadero Greyhound Foundation. Recreational drugs have been an issue on everyone's mind for a long, long time, 50-plus years. But one thing that absolutely astounds me is the, and it's dealt with in the book, the what appears to be increasing popularity of hard drugs like opioids, both prescription and on the street. What do you make of that? Since everybody knows they're so dangerous, leading to addiction or death in most cases, what do you make of that trend and how is the Lighthouse addressing that?
That is an answer that requires a long time, but I will say this, that the use of heroin in our community, which came in the early 2000s, 2010, 11, when we first started seeing it, was as a result of the opioid crisis that kids were discovering that opioids gave them great highs. Mm-hmm. And the high was there in grandma's medicine cabinet. When it was kind of discovered that the opioids were creating this great addiction problem, the drug companies did a couple things. One is that they made the dosages such that you couldn't get that big high. Well, and also the ability for kids to get a hold of it became more and more difficult. So kids discovered, because the drug dealers saw that, that heroin is that same has that same addictive property as the opioid. And so heroin's cheap relative to the opioids. And so the kids were using heroin as the substitute for the opioids. And then we had the addition of drugs like fentanyl just recently. We lost two kids in 2 weeks because of fentanyl-laced heroin.
Oh, boy.
And it's so heartbreaking. And part of the problem that we've had because of the COVID-19 is that our wellness centers and our counselors do not have the same accessibility to the kids that they had prior to the COVID. And that is a real problem for us. And we've seen the big strides that we had gained in 10 years. We've seen them backslide now because of the COVID, because of the lack of exposure that the kids had to their counselors and to their teachers on a daily basis.
That's very sad. Oh,
yes,
boy. Oh,
very sad, yes.
Well, here's another question that I'd like to pose to you. A lot of misbehavior, both of a young person and older, is the result of trauma of some kind, loneliness, maybe an abusive situation at home. which to me means that if you certainly can work on this or should work on the symptoms, let's say the drug use, but on abuse, but looking deeper, if you're going to get a permanent fix, it's going to be a family affair. Are families generally cooperative and upfront, and are they active participants?
Oh, yes, it does happen. In fact, it's a big part of what of our programs. One of our 12 programs is the, and I mentioned earlier, the reality tour. And reality tour, which is kind of a day in the life of an addict. And it goes through what happens from the time an addict is caught with heroin and then has an overdose and perhaps goes to jail. But it is parents and kids, and it's sixth graders through 12th graders and their parents. One of the things we do at the conclusion of that, we have a table talk thing where we buy 50 pizzas, and then the kids and their parents come in and ask questions of experts about drugs and drug use in our community and all this stuff. And it's all policemen and firemen and teachers and the members of our board who know what's going on. It's a time to encourage talking between kids and their parents. And that has been a very, very successful program for us. In fact, we have a lot of testimonials from people who say, you know, that they weren't talking to their kids before, but after reality tour, they put away the books and the phones and stuff at dinner, and that's when they talk.
Right.
And we've got some real good testimonials about that. So the kids love it when their parents are listening to them. And so we've found a lot of success with reality tour and the programs that go along with that.
As we get towards the end of our time together, what would be one or two or three things you'd want to put in the minds of people to be aware of this and how to ramp up, not only help your program, but if they live in a different community, how to ramp up something similar? What would you say to them?
Well, first of all, if you're in another community and you want to know what we did, just read the book, Lighthouse Weapon and Rescue. That is a real good diagram for how you could have your own program. And of course, we're here to help if you need help. And we hope that this is what happens, that the book becomes the manual for programs everywhere. I think that the kind of misconceptions, you know, people who don't know addiction and people who don't know somebody who has suffered through it tend to perhaps believe, not a blanket statement, but a number of people seem to believe that, you know, if you're not really addicted to something, just be strong and stop doing it. You know, if you're doing drugs, just stop doing them. It's like you smoke cigarettes, stop doing it. Well, we know that is not the case. But one of the things that I really want people to know, that's an important one. But the one thing is that the constructive use of leisure time is probably one of the most important phrases in dealing with drug problems, even perhaps before they start. But if your children are involved in a constructive use of their leisure time, then they don't have time for drugs. And that sounds kind of trite, and it sounds like a cliche, but it's really true, that sports and drama and skateboarding and anything you have to practice and it's constructive, that is a big drug prevention right there. And I think that's probably the biggest thing that we do, that we try to do, even with our Lighthouse After School programs, which don't appear to be drug related, but they are, because we're teaching kids how to cook and how to build a bicycle and how to build a computer and all of the things that go into our Lighthouse After School programs in our elementaries. And that's part of what Lighthouse funds. And so there's just so much, but it's all in the book.
This has been Brian Reynolds for Issues and Ideas on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we were joined by Don Clickard, Executive Director of the Atascadero Greyhound Foundation. Thank you, Don.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Brian.
And finally, let's travel back in time to 2012 when KCBX contributor Tom Wilmer was a part of Dublin, Ireland's St. Patrick's Day Parade. We aired this on KCBX at the time. This year, Dublin has had to cancel the famous parade due to the pandemic.
The only time I've been in the midst of 500,000 happy, festive people anywhere in the world was when I participated in St. Patrick's Parade in downtown Dublin, Ireland. Susan Kirby, director of the St. Patrick's Festival and Parade.
I have the great honor in being allowed to use Dublin as a playground for the 17th of March every year. The team and I are hosting all of the international media, all the domestic media, the Irish audiences, the people who come to visit, and we're going to put on a show today that we believe will really blow people away. It's a very special celebration. We have a number of US bands as well joining us, our US friends every year, very loyal to the parade. We have bands coming from Europe, America, and of course Irish bands as well. And then we have pageant companies in a very fun, quirky, innovative way brought to life through street theatre. There's so much to see and do as part of the whole programme.
And how many people are going to be at this parade? I heard some incredible numbers.
Yeah, well, it stretches through the capital, through all of our main streets. So we welcome in the region of 500,000 people on the streets of Dublin. It is, to a degree, weather dependent, so it will go up or down. But there's a very sizable, hardy crew of people who will turn up no matter the weather. And we've actually had very good weather in the last number of years. So we've had incredible figures. Around 500,000 should be on the streets today.
Hi, my name is Simon O'Connor. I'm from the Little Museum of Dublin and City of a Thousand Welcomes. And we're here just up near Parnell Square, which is in the centre of Dublin City, and it's where the St. Patrick's Day Parade is about to start. In the background, there's a marching band. It's interesting, marching bands were one of the first kind of theatrical aspects of the parade here in the city. It used to be really a boring event that children wouldn't enjoy going to. It was mainly companies advertising themselves. But gradually, as time went on, the parade became more theatrical. It started involving children more, involving theatre, much more colour and costume. And really, from the 1990s, that took off. And now Dublin's parade on every St. Patrick's Day is just a huge, colourful and theatrical event that involves community groups from all over the country. And as always, really superb marching bands from the US.
And there's a lot more than marching bands, isn't there?
A lot more than marching bands. We just walked past the Lord Mayor's carriage. He must have pimped his carriage. And there's just huge constructs. The St. Patrick's Day Parade began in the 1930s, really as an industrial parade, and has become much more about involving the whole community, not just the state, not just companies. We've always had visiting American marching bands. That was kind of the musical element, really, along with our own military marching bands.
Simon, thank you. This is great.
Thanks a million.
All right.
You've been listening to Susan Kirby, director of the St. Patrick's Festival and Parade, and Simon O'Connor, curator of the Little Dublin Museum. This is your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from downtown Dublin, Ireland, on St. Paddy's Day.
Hi, I'm Kira Segru. I'm with the trade marketing section of the National Tourist Board for Ireland, the Vulture Ireland, and delighted to be here talking to you today. This is a really special day for anyone who's Irish, and Dublin is really the place to be if you want to celebrate St. Patrick's Day in style. The parade is really something special, and there's a huge tradition of coming into the city with your family. You know, you see guys on the train with their ladders to make sure they come in early, to make sure they can see. We have up to about 600,000 people on the streets to watch this parade. For a lot of Dubliners, one of the highlights is seeing some of the US high school bands and the college bands who are coming over. And all over the city, we just had a big outdoor ceilidh out on the streets. Everyone could participate. Everyone gets out in their green and proud to be Irish, but we don't actually drink green beer here, contrary to what a lot of people might think. We stick to the black stuff here.
That's because the green dye wouldn't show up in the Guinness.
There is a beer craft festival on about the whole making of beer and helping some of the smaller breweries. The Jeannie Johnson, which is a very famous replica of a famine ship that would have left Ireland many years ago during the famine times, that's all been actually decked out and it's been completely greened for St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you guys so much. This has been a wonderful week.
Thanks, Tom, and say hello to everybody back in the States when you go home for us.
That was KCBX contributor Tom Wilmer taking part in Dublin, Ireland's St. Patrick's Day Parade back in 2012. This year, the parade was canceled due to the pandemic. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eister composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments, kcbx.org.